Let's talk about advisory fees. This is the one you've been waiting for. And this, the 93rd episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Welcome back, everybody. Today is my talk about fees in the advisory industry. I can already feel the weight of lots of other advisors rolling their eyes at me from their headphones, behind their headphones. This will be an informative one. I think it's an important one to know about and to discuss, to think about. It's a somewhat controversial one. It's definitely a hot topic. It very much divides a lot of the industry, for better or worse. But I think, I can say firsthand that the industry is trending towards some changes in the advisory fee structures offered. There's lots of momentum that I've witnessed in my few years since starting my business, and that momentum seems to be growing. So I'm not saying in my lifetime that the fee environment will be completely overhauled throughout the advisory industry, but there will be nonetheless substantial changes to it, and many more advisors offering varied fee structures, service offerings, et cetera, over the next 10, 20 years or whatever. So I'm excited to see where it goes. So this will be a good one, but before we get into it, I just wanted to let you know that I've started a boat building business in my attic, and man, sales are going through the roof. Do you get it? Okay, cool. Moving on. I don't have my sound machine here because I'm recording from home again today. My fancy little soundboard's at the office. So let's get into it. This episode is going to be it'd be very informative. I mean, it's me sort of spilling my thoughts and my views and pros and cons about different fee models and casual observations, both from my time before I was an advisor and in my time now during being an advisor. So it'll be part that I don't really have an outcome or objective for this. It's really just to, again, spill my thoughts on it. I think a lot of these things for both consumers and advisors alike will be helpful to think about, will be thought-provoking at a minimum, to say it kindly. Some people will learn some stuff from it, be it advisors or clients again, or, you know, consumers. So it'll be part that, just sort of, just sort of me spewing out information. I did try to gather my thoughts and categorize them and put some sort of logical flow. I got these notes in front of me here to this whole topic, but part of this will kind of eventually, you know, inevitably turn into quasi rant at times. So I'll try to refrain from that as much as possible. But anyway, let's get into it, see where this goes. So I want to start by saying that the advisory industry means a lot of different things. And before we talk about fees, we have to talk about the different types of advisors. Now, the word advisor itself, I absolutely hate. It's an unregulated term. Anyone could use it. There's no title restrictions around who calls themselves what: financial planner, financial advisor, wealth manager, wealth strategist. Some people get really cute and creative with names like tax exempt wealth specialist, safe money retirement specialist, all sorts of stuff like that. But this all sort of spawns from the fact that there's three distinctly different regulatory bodies that govern those in the financial services industry. So depending how the person is licensed or registered or which regulating body they're under, that dictates the product or service that they offer. So let me start with the first one is those who are licensed to sell insurance. These are regulated by each state. In order to sell insurance in a given state, you need to be licensed with that state's Department of Insurance or whatever that state chooses to call it, insurance commissioner, whatever. So this is for the ability, and I'm talking just about like life insurance and annuities, because I'm talking in the context of retirement planning, you know, the types of insurance products you are most likely to come across. But this also includes like health insurance, property and casualty insurance, stuff like auto insurance, homeowners insurance, whatever. But for purposes of today, I'm just going to leave this to like life insurance and annuities, which you need licenses for. So there are folks that are only licensed to sell those products. They're not licensed to sell securities like stocks or bonds or mutual funds. They're not licensed to manage investments. They're not licensed to just give financial advice. They can only give financial advice to the extent it is sort of tacked onto and on the periphery or incidental to the sale of the insurance product. So that's one. And they're paid from selling said products. They're not paid for giving advice. Next is securities licensed people. Just like those with insurance licenses can sell insurance products, those with securities licenses can sell securities. Again, stocks, bonds, mutual funds. There will be a commission belying the sale of that product. Unlike insurance, where you're regulated at each state in which you operate, when you are securities licensed, the overarching parent organization is called FINRA, F-I-N-R-A, which stands for Financial Industry something Regulatory Authority. So in order to sell a stock, a bond, a mutual fund, you need to be registered nationally with FINRA. So that's the second type. The third type is investment advisor representatives, or those that manage investments for people. Like they pick on your behalf which stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever, to buy or sell within your account. They're not the ones actually selling the security to you. They're just the third party picking for you which ones you buy or sell from a separate brokerage. They're not the broker. They're just the third party making the decision for you. So that's the third kind. And this is where it gets messy. Like those who want to give broader financial advice, including advice about investments, but not directly manage them for you, they'd also have to register as an investment advisor representative. Now, if you do manage assets and you have enough assets, it's roughly $100 million. There's some little wiggle room to it. But if you manage at least $100 million for clients, you have to register nationally with the Securities and Exchange Commission. If you manage less than that, again, there's some exceptions. You have to register at the state level. Each state, your home state, you have to register in, and then potentially other states, depending how many clients you have in those states. You also have to register with each state as an investment advisor representative. And then there are, let's call it hybrid advisors. This just simply means that they have any combination of the above three things. They can sell insurance, they can sell securities, or they can manage investments / give financial advice. That's hybrid. And then there's I'll call it a fourth. I mean, it's far from it to call these people advisors, but then there's just like coaches, people who just give you general tips and guidance around budgeting, paying down debt, general financial things, but they cannot sell insurance. They cannot sell securities. They cannot manage investments. They cannot even talk about investments or give you recommendations or guidance about investments. Once they cross that line, they then need to be an investment advisor representative and get registered accordingly. So coaches are really just, again, like cash flow, debt, budgeting, stuff like that. They can't really get into investments for you. So those are the different types of advisors. It's hard to tell who's who and what license they have and what product or service they ultimately represent. There's some ways to go about it. For example, anyone who is securities licensed or an investment advisor representative will be on what's called Broker Check. And I'll share a link to that. That's a site run by FINRA. And it shows everyone who has or had licenses to either sell securities and or manage investments. So you can find it there. So for example, if someone approaches you to sell you the latest, greatest product, and you look them up on Broker Check and there's zero record of them, chances are they're only licensed to sell insurance. So the product they're looking to sell you is going to be an insurance product. Because if they don't have, again, securities licenses or investment management registrations, they can't sell securities or manage investments. So they're not going to be on Broker Check, hence they probably just sell insurance. Or maybe they are a financial coach, in which case they shouldn't be talking about investments at all. Because again, they just really can only talk about like budgeting, debt, sort of psychology of money type stuff, things like that. So I already mentioned that there's no standardization of titles or labels. Anyone can call themselves anything for the most part within the industry. There's also not really standardization of service or product, which you may have already felt out by now from me laying out the fact that there's, distinctly different regulatory regimes that oversee different activities, such as, again, insurance sales, security sales, investment advisor representatives, hybrids of those, or, financial coach, if you will. There's no standardization of fees or compensation methods either. So those who only sell insurance will get paid commission from the insurance products they sell. To my knowledge, there's, unless they have other registrations, you know, someone who sells insurance can't just charge you $1,000 to give you some financial advice. Like, they ultimately, the only way they get paid is from selling the insurance product, where they then get a commission, you know, paid to them from the insurance company. Indirectly, you're paying for that in the product, but not directly. It's not a direct fee to you most, if not all the times. Same thing with those who sell securities. This is like traditional stockbrokers who don't really exist, or I mean, they still exist, but not like they did 30, 40, whatever, 20, 30 years ago, where they just call you up to try to pump and sell you stocks. You know, security salespeople get paid a commission, whether it's a mutual fund or stock they sell you or whatever. There's a commission associated with the sale of that product. That's, you know, that's the commission or the fee model, compensation model for security sales. Those who are investment advisor representatives, this is where it gets, and this is going to be the rest of this conversation today. Excuse me, had a tickle in my throat here. They can get paid a few ways, but ultimately it is fee for service where the client's paying. Maybe the client's paying from the fees coming directly out of the investment accounts that the advisor manages. Maybe the fee is paid like directly out of pocket, where the advisor could be sending the client a bill or an invoice. The client can pay through cash, check, credit card, you know, bank ACA draft. Those are all fee for service. Client directly pays the advisor. Again, could be out of assets, but still the advisor's paying. It's not a product-based, commission-based arrangement. Hybrid firms or hybrid advisors, those that can sell products and can manage investments and or give advice, could get compensated in multiple ways. You know, they could charge you just a outright fee to do a one-time financial plan for you. They can then, if you do choose to have them manage your investments, they can additionally then charge you a ongoing fee to manage those investments. If they initially or occasionally, you know, sell you a mutual fund that has a commission on it or an insurance policy or something, they can also then get commissions from the sale of that product. Sadai, moving on. So now I don't want to really name names necessarily, but like, I'm just trying to give examples of different firms or businesses that might be, or that you can tell are just insurance or just securities or whatever. So any large household, you know, national insurance company you've ever heard of definitely has insurance licenses. The person, they may or may not also have like investment advisory licenses or security sales licenses. So for example, you come across someone from New York Life or MetLife or Mass Mutual, Northwestern Mutual, you know, Nationwide, whatever. These are all insurance companies. They're going to have insurance licenses and will be, you know, willing and able to sell you insurance products. Maybe they also work for the advisory entity of those companies. So in addition to having insurance licenses, they could also manage investments. They may also have securities licenses where they could also, you know, sell you, you know, mutual funds or other individual securities or something like that. Stepping away from insurance, there's the what the industry calls wirehouses, which is kind of an outdated term but still sticks around. It's basically the large national brokerages like the Merrill Lynch's, the Edward Jones, the Chase one, I guess JP Morgan. Wells Fargo now is one as well. Who else have we got? UBS, I believe, would be classified as a wirehouse. Raymond James, things like that. I don't know if Raymond James, well, whatever. I guess functionally it kind of is. So these are large places that the advisors there will have securities licenses so they can sell securities. And they will also have investment advisory licenses so they can also manage investments. Maybe they can also do standalone one-time plans or hourly work. Not common, but it's possible. But generally speaking, the ways in which they will earn fees is either through selling products for commission and or managing investments and typically charging a percent of assets as the fee for that service. So those are some examples of those. Examples of people or firms that are pure investment advisor representatives. A lot of the smaller shops, like solo operations, newer, smaller firms, are trending towards being what's called RIA only, registered investment advisory firms, RIA only, where they only manage investments and or give advice, that they don't sell securities, they don't sell insurance. So a lot of smaller places may be like this. there are some really large national RIA only firms, again, firms that only manage investments or only give advice. I think like Fisher Investments, and this is in no means a recommendation to use them. I'm just saying it's probably a name that most of everyone listening has heard of. I believe they are RIA only, meaning they only manage investments and don't give advice. Well, I don't know if they even just give advice. I think they only manage investments where you have to have at least $500,000 under management. But point is, like, they definitely don't sell insurance, and I don't believe they sell securities either. So they're not going to have licenses to do those. All right. So that is sort of the backdrop of the advisory landscape and how people are regulated, registered, and sort of how that translates into products and services offered and potential fees or you know, compensation or commissions involved. Again, like the rest of this episode is really just focused on the investment advisory only places. So basically rules out all of the insurance companies you've ever heard of, all of the large household brokerage firm names you've ever heard of, rules them out because those are all hybrid where they have sales licenses. I'm really just focusing on the investment management and or giving of financial advice firms, which are, again, the RIA only, registered investment advisory only. So with that said, I'm going to start and wrap this episode with my takeaways, my summary thoughts on advisory fees. Again, I'm talking from the context of advisors who both manage investments, their services to manage investments, and do ongoing various forms of financial planning, which I'll touch on some of what those examples are. So I'm talking about that structure. I'm not really talking about those who only offer planning without doing investment management, or those who only manage investments without doing any sort of planning, though I guess that would apply in today's episode. But I'm really focusing on those who do a combined offering of managing investments and doing good, thorough, ongoing planning. So again, I'll start with this summary of my thought and takeaway on fees, and I'll end with it because I think it's important to think about. So first, no fee model is perfect, right? So let me start by saying that. I'm not here to say I have the answer, the solution to everything. This is, indisputably the right way to do it. No fee model is perfect, but some are more imperfect than others. And you'll sort of catch the theme here. I my views are nothing's perfect, but why can't we strive to make things less imperfect, right? Or let's use the least imperfect model, because don't we sort of owe it to ourselves and consumers in the industry to do that? Next, no fee model is free from conflict. Anyone who says it is conflict-free is absolutely lying. They may not know it, but they're lying. So no fee model is free from conflict. However, some are more prone to conflicts than others. So don't we sort of owe it to the industry, to consumers, to strive to use a fee model that is the least inherently conflicted? Next, virtually no advisor works for free. If you think that's the case, you're either paying commissions and don't know it, or you're paying an advisory fee out of your assets and don't know it. Now, to be fair, there are some advisors who do truly offer free services, but I mean, this is like literally under a pro bono offering. So typically, I was going to say larger firms often do this, but not necessarily. I know some small firms that do. Some firms who do realize their services are priced such that, people who don't have a lot of assets or income, who arguably are in the most of need of these services, can't afford them. So some firms do have a true free pro bono offering, in which case, yes, it is free. But vast majority of people listening, anyone who's ever come across or used an advisor, it is not free. If you think it's free, like, look again, because you're paying for it somehow. Next, this is a big one. Pay attention to the dollars you're paying each year, not the percentage. I'm taking a pause. Intentional pause? No, forget that. Moving on. I tried to be fancy. There's some word for it. Like when you say something important and stop and pause and just let it soak in, there's a name for it, but I'm blanking on the name. So I'll stop pretending like I know what it is. But I'll re-say it. Pay attention to the dollars in fee you're paying, not the percentage in fee you're paying. And you'll see throughout the rest of this episode why that makes sense. Next, there's no universally right amount of fee per se. But so long as you feel you're getting more value from the relationship than the dollars you're paying, the service can make sense. And that applies regardless of what you're paying, whether you're paying $500 a year or $50,000 a year. If you truly think and feel you're getting at least that much in value or benefit, then it's worth it. I forget who said it. It may be Warren Buffett, but like cost only matters in the absence of value, or I'm probably butchering this, but so long as the value is more than the cost, like, you know, it's worth it. As long as you're getting more than you're paying, it could be worth it for you. Next, most of the value in good advisory relationship is impossible to quantify. So be skeptical of any advisor who offers up any sort of formal or informal promise that their value, the value of their service, will exceed their fee or exceed their fee by some multiple. Why is it impossible? Not all value is impossible to measure, but a lot of it, I'd argue the majority of it, is impossible to measure. I wrote an article on it, and I'll share a link to the article in the notes. This will help give some good examples of why this is the case, but I'll sort of summarize it very briefly. A lot of the value in a good advisory relationship is subjective or emotional, like the ability to sleep well at night, knowing that someone who hopefully knows what they're doing is on your side, helping you make decisions, whether it's just investments or other stuff about your financial life. The fact that you have someone helping look out for you, that peace of mind could be immeasurable, invaluable to some people. You know, they can't put a dollar amount on it. To others, the peace of mind means nothing. Like some people will try to quantify to the penny every single thing they're getting out of the relationship, like monetarily, every single thing they're getting out of the relationship. They'll put virtually or zero, no value on the subjective sort of peace of mind deliverable of the advisory relationship. So for two different people, they can have very different interpretations and understandings and amounts of value they're getting for purely emotional subjective reasons. And again, those cannot be quantified. So that right there is impossible to put a dollar amount on, for most people at least. Next are things that could theoretically have the value quantified, but not until like decades down the road. An example of this would be, we all know it's, you know, prudent guidance to say you should not have all your eggs in one basket. So if someone comes, you know, a consumer comes to an advisor and has $1 million, all of which is in one stock, the advisor is going to be like, oh man, like that's dangerous, right? We all know that the right guidance is that you should diversify out of that. You don't have to get rid of it completely, but diversify out of it to whatever, you know, at least 10 stocks, 30 stocks, 500 stocks, an index fund, whatever it may be, diversify that risk. Now, that's good advice. You know, I'm not saying that's bad advice, but what's to say, hypothetically, rewind to the year 2003, you know, we're coming out of the bottom of the tech bust. What's to say a consumer didn't have all their money in Amazon stock, let's say, and an advisor in 2003 would have been like, oh man, you got to diversify away from that. So they did. So the advisor had the client change out of Amazon into whatever, five different index funds and some other stuff. And who knows, doesn't matter. Fast forward till now, you know, 20 years later, 21 years later, I guess. I'm going to venture to say that had the consumer kept all their investable assets in Amazon, they'd have substantially more money today than they actually do because they instead diversified into the advisor's, recommended portfolio. Now that wasn't bad advice. The outcome was suboptimal. You know, the client was financially worse off because of the advice, but it wasn't bad advice. Don't mistake a bad outcome for bad advice. They're very different things, right? So, but the point is, what value was added in this scenario? Again, going back, I can say it was a good decision. It was a good recommendation to tell the consumer that he or she needed to diversify away from just Amazon. But in hindsight, 21 years later, that ended up being a worse outcome than had they stayed in Amazon. So what's the value of that? Like, you can't put a dollar on that. Or if you did, it'd be like negative value, arguably, right? So that's another thing that, you know, can't be quantified, or if you can, not till decades down the road, where you have to truly track what would the outcome have been versus what was the actual outcome after having implemented the advisor's advice. So that's another big example where, you know, you can't really quantify it. And then some things can actually be quantified indisputably, you know, very numerically measured. But those are, in my experience, the minority often. Or if there are large quantifiable things, it's not every year where the advisor is going to consistently produce this result where they're, you know, he or she is indisputably in that year, measurably unlocking X amount of value from some particular thing. You know, a lot of the value, again, is going to be decades down the road, or this emotional subjective stuff where you can't actually realistically measure it. So, all right. So that's my sort of thoughts on value. what else? So as I mentioned, I'm going to focus on the investment advisory firms, those that do investment management planning. Now, historically, the industry, you know, those in this investment advisory world, historically, they were just investment managers. They would pick securities, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever, inside clients' portfolios. They would rebalance them a few times a year, multiple times a year, whatever. They do some trading. But that was really it. There wasn't a lot of additional planning per se. They might throw in some light planning on the periphery, like maybe give some general guidance about Social Security or, you know, some other stuff like that. But the core of the service offering was they're really just picking individual, you know, picking securities, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, exchange traded funds, whatever. That was their value. That's where they hung their hat. Now, sort of sidebar here, but they rarely would measure, or you know, my experience, such managers would rarely measure their outcome, you know, how their portfolios performed relative to what some benchmark did. I'm not talking about mutual fund managers. I'm talking about like advisors who work with individual clients, where each client has his or her own sort of customized portfolio. It's not often that the advisor would show the returns of their portfolio relative to some broader index or benchmark measure. It does happen, but you know, hasn't been the norm historically. But anyway, so point is, historically, it was really just managing investments. Over time, over the last 20 years, 10 years, definitely, there's been a trend to having to provide more. Clients and advisors are realizing investment management isn't where the main value is in this relationship. It's a part of it. Managing investments is a valuable service for many people, but it's not the core of it. There's much more value and opportunities and things to do around the rest of the planning. And so the industry has trended more towards like, yeah, people still manage investments, but the core of the service is really sort of morphing towards the planning. So what is planning? What's that mean? It could mean a lot of things. I mean, this is one of my pet peeves. There isn't a formally accepted, there might be, but not one that I'm aware of, a industry-wide formally accepted definition of financial planning. But I feel like I know it when I see it. So here's some of an example. In typical sort of retirement distribution planning, which is what my focus is in my business and probably what all of you listening are most interested in, here's an example of what's involved or what should be offered and involved in a good comprehensive investment management and planning offering. Obviously, management investments, let's start with that. You know, clients will often have an IRA, Roth IRA, brokerage accounts, health savings account, maybe a donor advised fund perhaps, where the advisor is managing those, picking the securities investments in those, rebalancing them on occasion, you know, doing the trades behind that. When new money comes into the account, the advisor is figuring out where to put that money. When money needs to come out, you know, client needs to take a distribution, advisor is the one figuring out what to sell and why. So that's the investment management. That's always been around. Now it's, you know, it's still around, but it's sort of taken some of a backseat to the rest of the planning. So the rest of the planning would be things like integrating and learning about and planning around other sources of income for the client, not just those from the investable portfolio, such as Social Security, pensions if they got them, rentals, you know, if they have a rental property, any business income, even if it's a small little like side hustle thing, quilting blankets or whatever. That's another sort of area of income that a good advisor who does planning will capture and account for and plan around for clients. Helping with decisions around gifting and donations, whether it's like gifting to family or friends or donating to charity, both in life and in death. So like the legacy planning, estate planning is all tied into good financial planning. Now, most financial planners aren't lawyers, so they can't actually create like wills and trusts for you. They can help give guidance on those and help work with the lawyers who can. But estate planning is more than just wills and trusts. It's also like making sure beneficiaries are named correctly on retirement accounts and helping map out and think through what do you want to happen to your assets when you die, to the extent maybe you start gifting away some of your assets now in life as opposed to waiting until you're gone, is all part of estate planning. Cash flow, factoring in expenses, both now and in the future, to determine the feasibility of, can I actually spend as much as I want to, or do I have enough assets to last, or what other income sources could I use to pair off and cover my expenses, and helping clients adjust and adapt and manage expenses and planning around that as life inevitably changes. There will be good markets and bad markets throughout, the decades of retirement, helping stay nimble and agile around that. There will be sickness and death in relationships, planning around that. Oftentimes these things are unexpected, that they throw a big unforeseen curveball into plans. Change of residence, people want to downsize, move out of state, move to a lower tax state, move to be near family and friends. There's lots of financial implications around that, emotional implications as well, that good advisors who do financial planning can help think through. Marriages and divorces have lots of implications financially that financial planning could help with. Change in just lifestyle in general. Like, you go from loving pickleball to all of a sudden, I had enough. 2 years of pickleball every day is enough for me. I'm moving on. I now have a new hobby where I'm going to do whatever. Needlepoint or fishing or whatever it may be. That all changes your finances and circumstances around it. Help with decisions around buying or selling real estate and the financial impacts of that. Getting a mortgage, a reverse mortgage, renting properties, stuff like that. Tax planning. This is a biggie. This is another one where it's hard to define, but I know it when I see it. Tax planning would be things like, for those that do have investable assets in normal brokerage accounts, not IRAs or Roth IRAs, harvesting gains or losses intentionally for tax management reasons. Proactive income and tax planning and projections each year, helping clients map out, where's my income coming from? What's the tax implications of it and why? What are we trying to solve for? We're trying to keep our gross income to a certain level. We're trying to keep taxes paid to a certain level. We're trying to keep net cash flow to a certain level, whatever. Doing detailed projections around that are integral, important, vital aspects of good financial planning for those in or near retirement. Helping with tax-efficient charitable giving. There's ways to donate to charity that could be more tax advantageous to you, the donee, or donor, I guess, the one who gives, as opposed to just like giving money willy-nilly. There's ways to think through and do this as tax efficiently as possible. Gifting, which means giving money to non-charities, to kids, to family, to friends, whatever. There's ways to tax efficiently do that with a sort of a long-term view on estate planning, wealth transfer. Longer-term tax, potential tax mitigation through things like Roth conversions. That's all tax planning. Thinking through wealth transfer legacy planning, like step up in basis for positions in regular taxable accounts. Use of insurance, life insurance. These are all things that play into wealth transfer and sort of, final estate planning thoughts. Income planning around Affordable Care Act for those that are on Affordable Care Act or those on Medicare, trying to keep your income to certain levels for premium surcharge purposes. These are all examples of tax planning. So anyway, so all these things I just mentioned in the last, 3 to 5 minutes, these are all broader, quote unquote, financial planning things above and beyond just the management of investments, beyond just the picking and rebalancing and trading of investments. This is where the core of the value is for those in or near retirement. It's not just management investments. It's all this planning stuff, right? Does that make sense? So with that said, the fee should somehow be set commensurate with all that other stuff, all that planning that's being provided and done, not just the picking of investments. Advisory services are a professional service. What do we offer? We're not offering products. Those that sell insurance offer products. Those that sell securities offer products. Those that sell aluminum siding sell a product. Those that sell replacement windows sell a product. We sell a service, not uncommon from lawyers or doctors or architects or accountants or whatever, consultants. We offer our time, resources, expertise, knowledge, etc. Even those that manage investments, even if that's the majority or solely what you do is manage investments, what's actually getting delivered? Like, what are we doing? We're still ultimately offering time, resources, expertise, knowledge, etc. We're not offering returns. We're not offering growth. Some advisors do. Some advisors do try to hang their hat on our value is we can outperform some index. Well, great. If that's what you pitch your value as, well, you should charge on some defined measure of outperformance. Don't just charge on total asset size, because markets go up more than they go down. So generally speaking, accounts are going to go up, all else equal. If you're saying you can outperform the market, you have to agree on a measurement of what the market is. You then have to define how to measure it. You then, you know, look at what your portfolio returned, and to the extent it exceeded the benchmark, then yes, you outperformed and you can charge on that outperformance. But what happens in years where you underperform? You will inevitably have years where you perform worse than the benchmark. So you're going to give money back to the client? I doubt it. Anyway, so that's sort of the framing I wanted to give, like with this backstory of what's involved in investment management and what's involved in the broader financial planning that's now more commonly provided along with investment management. Think about the service. It's time, it's knowledge, it's resources, it's expertise. It's not a product. It's not investment outperformance. Again, some people try to do that, but majority of times that's not the case. All right. So now let's get into what the different potential fee models are for advisory firms. There's pure hourly. I mean, I think everyone sort of knows what this is. You come up with an hourly rate, be it $200, $500, whatever. And you just simply kind of run the clock. You know, every hour you provide working for a client, you charge that much fee and you batch up the fee to every quarter, every year or whatever. Or in some cases, if you're doing like a limited scope engagement where your client has a few questions and you agree ahead of time, okay, the engagement's going to be, I'll answer these questions. It's going to take, let's say, 4 hours all said and done for analysis and, you know, presentation, whatever. And you charge a flat fee based on 4 hours of work. And there you go. So pure hourly is one option. Complexity based. This is where you try to factor in all of the different needs and complexity angles of a client's planning and investment management needs and charge based on that, realizing that no two clients are identical, truly identical. Some have more or less complexity. Like maybe some client has a rental property you're going to need to advise on. Maybe some client has 8 different investment accounts instead of one. Maybe some client has 2 different pensions they need to decide between as opposed to no pensions. Maybe some client is a lot more active in charitable giving than another. Like those are all different areas of complexity that some advisory firms have fee structures that try to account for the more or less difference in complexity between clients and charge on the amount of complexity. Next is flat fee. There's lots of derivations of this. My firm is kind of an extreme example where the fee is the fee is the fee. You know, all clients pay the same. Others have sort of bands of flat fees where, you know, if you're minimum complexity, your fee is X per year. If you're medium complexity, your fee is Y per year. If you're high complexity, your fee is Z per year. If you don't fit in one of those three, well, you're not a client. And sort of same thing with my firm where we have just one flat fee. We sort of self-select clients where the services they need and sort of the complexity of their situations make sense for the fee offered. Those that are more complex, you know, noticeably more complex or noticeably less complex, we will say we're not the right fit because our fee isn't, you know, mutually sensible in that case. So anyway, that's flat fee. And then there's percent of AUM, which stands for percent of assets under management. This is the most common and was most common, still is most common, where you simply look at the investable assets that the client directly manages and charge a fee on that. Typically, it's like 1% of that, you know, 1% every year broken up as into 0.25% per quarter. Is what the fee is on those assets under management. Some advisors have sort of alternate structures of this where it's like percent of net worth. It's not just percent of those assets that they directly manage, it's percent of the client's total net worth. Or some even have like percent of income, maybe by itself or maybe in addition to percent of net worth or percent of assets or something. So those are the four main ones in a nutshell. Pure hourly, complexity-based, flat fee, or percent of AUM. Let me touch briefly on the pros and cons of each. Hourly, in theory, I think this is the most equitable because it directly, again, we're a professional service. We provide knowledge and time and resources and expertise and whatever. Hourly, in my opinion, most closely ties the fee, you know, the cost of the service with the service actually provided as measured by hours. It's imperfect. Again, these are all imperfect. But I think in theory, this makes a lot of sense, arguably the most sense. Works well for limited engagement services. Like I said before, if client just has like 4 questions they want answered and that's it, you know, no ongoing service beyond that, then hourly could work well. It doesn't work well for ongoing, especially when it's like ongoing inclusive investment management. And if client has questions or whatever, they're going to be reluctant to call or pick up the phone for fear of running the clock and charging a fee. So a potentially small issue that a client could call up the advisor and, you know, get squared away in the course of an hour may become a big issue because they don't want to address it now. They just wait and it blows up into something big that now takes like 10 hours to unwind or fix or whatever. So I think there's this inherent conflict where pure hourly is going to restrict an ongoing relationship from working well, at least ongoing, you know, for financial planning investment management in other industries, you know, I guess it makes sense. Like lawyers, for example, charge sort of a retainer then hourly on top of it. But for investment management, where like there needs to be ongoing servicing and monitoring and actions the portfolio throughout the year, and there needs to be ongoing, often preventative financial planning discussions and talks and things, hourly sort of is going to make a lot of clients reluctant to really make the most of the service. So I don't think it's going to work well for ongoing. Next would be complexity-based. The pros of this is it can very logically and closely tie the fee with the actual complexity, where complexity could be a much better measure of what's provided as opposed to just boiling it down to pure hours. You know, complexity could, in theory, capture how much specialization of knowledge or expertise is required in a certain thing, you know, not just time. How much outside reliance on other professionals and experts is needed to get pulled into the equation, things like that. So that could make a lot of sense, and I like it in concept. But in actuality, it could be, not could be, but it is difficult to come up with and calibrate a fee model that accurately captures all or most of the areas of complexity that need to be captured. I originally tried to do that, and I had this like 12-point matrix that I thought was real slick. And then the more I thought about it and tweaked it and refined it, I was like, oh man, this is just clunky and unwieldy. It's going to require constant tweaking and recalibration. Every year, as people's complexity changes, it's going to require tweaking it. And there's going to be ongoing discussions of, okay, your fee should now be this. Client will be like, well, why? I don't agree that it's more or less complex or whatever. And so there's always going to be a sort of like, I don't want to say pushback, but a lot of noise around trying to change and recalibrate and discuss what's actual changes in complexity, what's not. In theory, again, works great, but in reality, it seems like a lot of trouble. Now, I know a lot of firms do this and it works well for them, so I'm not saying it can't work. Definitely can, but it just seems like it's clunky to do right, I should say. Flat fee. Pro of that, it's very simple. You know, if your fee is $10,000, there you go. Boom, $10,000. Everyone knows what it is. It's clear. It's in your face. You don't have to do any math behind the scenes to figure it out. It's just, this is your fee. Now, it could work well, or I mean, not could, but does it works best, works well for advisors who have clients who are sort of like, homogenous is not the best word, but I think it sort of works, whose client base is homogenous in their wants, their needs, their sort of planning opportunities. These services the advisor provides are, you know, the more those are similar across the base of clients, the more a flat fee makes sense. And that's what in my firm I do, as I sort of touched on. We have a kind of tightly defined definition or archetype of client we want to work with, who all sort of want and need and can benefit from it and have loosely similar financial circumstances, that the fee makes sense. Again, it's imperfect. All these are. But it's I truly feel, and I now have almost 5 years of running my firm, I guess 4.5, of you know, data point to say, yes, this has worked out to be the case where this flat fee does make a lot of sense. Still imperfect, but makes a lot more sense than these other methods we're discussing, because the client base is so, you know, very similar. It's also good. It helps advisors from undercharging clients. So like percent of assets, which we'll talk about next, many times, especially for advisors who work with clients of smaller asset size, clients aren't paying enough. And so advisors are giving away more than they should for a relatively small fee. So flat fee helps prevent that. Now, the downside of that is flat fee, assuming your fee is set at a not tiny level, will prevent you from working with certain clients, you know, because clients simply won't be able to afford a flat fee. If your flat fee is $10,000 a year, that rules out a lot of the population, unfortunately. In that case, percent of assets could be better. Well, will be better for the client because it means they'd be paying less. But, you know, my view is, again, we're a professional service. How many other professional services give away their services shy of pure pro bonos or otherwise like do it at highly reduced fees simply for people's willingness and ability to pay, right? Like it's not common. Now doctors, medicine, that's a bad example. Because that there's, you know, the whole concept of insurance greatly muddies, really distorts the real pricing and fee structure of medical services. But think about things like lawyers, architects, accountants, whatever. They generally have some minimum fee, be it hourly, be it flat fee, be it whatever it is. Like it is what it is, and people can't afford it, unfortunately can't afford it. Now, in the advisory world, that's sort of the model I have, for better or worse. There's still lots of other advisors out there who are willing and able and have fee structures and models built around working with people who are willing and able to to pay smaller amounts. But point is, from the advisor perspective, having a flat fee could be good in that it can help prevent the advisor from undercharging his or her services. On the flip side, I'd say bad for the advisor, good for the client. It could help prevent overcharging of clients. Just like clients with small asset sizes often underpay for what they actually get, clients of large asset size often overpay for what they actually get. Now, I realize saying underpay and overpay are subjective. These are my views, my opinions, in my experience of what I've seen in my time before I was an advisor, my time since I've been an advisor. I can say this is held to be accurate, where clients of small asset size do often underpay. Clients of large asset size do often overpay for what they get. Again, acknowledging overpay and underpay are subjective terms, but if someone's paying $30,000 a year for advisory services and they have a really straightforward scenario, like I'm going to go out and say that's overpaying. I'm pretty confident in putting those words out there. All right, next. So that's flat fee. Now, to help get around the idea of having like at one extreme, my firm is like a pure flat fee. Everyone pays the same thing. There can be different bands of flat fees. Like I said before, a low, a medium, a high complexity fee. So that can sort of help massage a little bit the extremities or the extremeness or whatever of not being able to work at really small asset sizes or really large asset sizes. You can sort of tweak, and I shouldn't say asset size. I mean complexity bases. You can tweak it by having multiple flat fees. And then percent of assets is the fourth. Let's talk about pros and cons of that. Pro, it's been the standard, I won't say forever, but for a really long time. It's easy to understand, easy to implement. The majority of the industry is built around it, advisors and service providers alike. So when advisors go out and get portfolio management software or other, certain custodial platforms where the custodian charges a percent of asset fee, that all lends itself to being in the percent of asset ecosystem. So there's that. Now, this could be a pro and a con, but it's means tested percent of assets. I mean, the math is easy. Smaller the asset size, the smaller the fee. I'm not talking about percentages. I'm talking about dollars. Dollars are what matters. Get over the nonsense of thinking about fees and percentages. What ultimately matters is the dollars you're paying every year. So percent of assets is a means tested arrangement where those that are small asset size don't pay a lot. Those that are high asset size pay much more. In that sense, you can sort of view it as like a subsidy arrangement, especially for clients who have like no asset minimums and work with advisors who have no asset minimums and will work with clients of any size, regardless how small. And I know some firms like this, they freely acknowledge, yeah, we in effect lose money on these smaller relationships. If not for the larger assets, larger clients who have a few million dollars of assets with us paying tens of thousands of dollars a year, we wouldn't be able to serve these smaller clients. So let's call it what it is, as a subsidy arrangement in that case. Now, a lot of advisors get around this by simply setting a high asset minimum. Like we only work with people, not we, but I'm talking about like in general, advisors say we only work with clients that have $1 million or more. Well, that then rules out the subsidy arrangement because you're not providing services to those who aren't paying at least $10,000 a year or whatever. So in that case, it's kind of like you're getting the upside, but without the downside. So is that really the best? Well, anyway, we'll leave that there. And the other big con, and this is one of my big gripes with it, of percent of assets is asset size. Investable asset size is a terrible indicator of what a client's financial complexity is. Excuse me. So let's not pretend like it is. In some cases, it may coincidentally, the dollar amount of fee under percent of asset may coincidentally work out to a fair, reasonable, defensible fee based on client complexity. But that's just happenstance. On a standalone basis, percent of or asset size is a really, really poor indicator of complexity or services provided or time required or resources provided or expertise required, et cetera. Asset size doesn't get you there. All right. So now I'm going to focus on percent of assets simply because that's the norm. And so I want to share my thoughts about that. Simply put, the more investable assets you have, the more you pay. Again, asset size is a really poor indicator of the time, resources, complexity, expertise needed, et cetera, et cetera. Now, most firms do have some sort of fee tiered structure where if your assets are over a certain amount, you pay a lower percentage. Once they're over even another amount, you pay an even lower percentage. So it's tiered or breakpoints or whatever different structures people have. But still, unless there's a hard cap, a dollar amount cap, they all relate to the more assets you have, the more you pay. So let's give an example and you'll see. Now, granted, this is a manufactured extreme example, but I know many advisors have client situations like this, so it's not like this is completely fictitious. Example, Client A has $2 million in an IRA, and that's it. No other accounts under the advisor's management. They're not taking any distributions because they're living off pension and Social Security. So there's no like active selling of positions to distribute, et cetera. The client likes passive investments. They're very hands-off. They don't freak out when the market whips around. So they're in a few different funds. There's some minimal trading activity just to really kind of rebalance a few times a year, et cetera. But that's that. There will be some required minimum distributions at some point when the person's in their 70s. But for now, again, there's no ongoing distributions or anything. Clients are very hands-off. Under a typical sort of one, to some people even charge as high as 1.5% on up to $2 million, that would mean an annual assets under management fee of $20,000 to $30,000 a year in fees. Now, there are some who charge less. You know, many advisors will have breakpoints such that you're not paying 1.5% on the full 2 million. Now, some advisors do charge, again, 1.5% up to a full 2 million, but most advisors don't charge that level. It'll be less, but still point is you're easily looking at 10 grand of fees, 15 grand of fees, if not 20 or even $30,000 a year in fees. So that's client A. Client B has $1 million in total with the advisor across an IRA, a Roth IRA, and a taxable brokerage account that has 24 different positions, all of which have various levels of unrealized gain or loss because they were bought, you know, throughout however many years. This client is actively taking distributions out of their accounts. So the advisor needs to figure out each year how much money to take out from which account, the IRA, Roth IRA, taxable account, and or, you know, in which combination for tax purposes, because that's going to matter. There's more trading and selling activity within the accounts because there are recurring ongoing, let's just say monthly distributions across these accounts. There's much more tax implications and tax planning needed around the scenario, again, because there's three different accounts from which you're distributing, or potentially three, which you're distributing, that all have different tax characteristics to it. Furthermore, the client's like a very nervous, emotional person where every time the market's down 1% or they watch CNBC that day, they call you up and say, hey, should we do this? Should we do that? Should we get out? Whatever, whatever. They also have a rental property that you happen to advise on as part of your broader services. Again, $1 million in total. Under a typical 1% to 1.5% AUM fee, that means this client's paying $10,000 to $15,000 a year. The point is this client's paying half of roughly half, I mean, give or take the break points and actual percentages, but this client who's paying roughly half what client A is, and no one could defensibly and logically say client A is more work, more resources, more expertise, more whatever than client B. Quite the opposite. Yet, client A is paying substantially more than client B. That's a prime example of my beef and my hang up with percent of assets. How is that logically possible? Now, later in this episode, man, this is going to be a while. Sorry about that. But later in the episode, I do have some talking points, common reasons, points of defense for percent of assets. And I'll touch on that, how some would attempt to justify this. But that's just a glaring example of this makes absolutely no sense. Yet this is what the majority of the industry still does. With percent of assets, the fee fluctuates every quarter. Even, the same thing, you're charging the same 1%, 1.5%, whatever. But on an asset base, that's going to vary every quarter as the markets go up or go down. Market goes up, all else equal, advisor gets paid more, even though the advisor may not be doing any more, actually doing less. Oftentimes, when markets go up, everyone's happy. Client's happy, right? Like everyone's feeling good. They're not calling up. They're not asking for things. They're not nervous. Accounts going up, yet advisor's getting paid more. Even if, let's just say, the investments the advisor chose went up less than what the broader index or market could have done. So had the client just been in some simple underlying index fund, as opposed to the advisor's, 24 actively managed funds, they could have actually went up more, yet the advisor's still getting paid more, right? So that's, anyway, it doesn't sit well with me. On the flip side, when the market goes down, advisor gets paid less. Even though many times when markets go down, especially when it's large drops, there's more work to do as an advisor. There's more expertise, resources, time, et cetera, needed when markets drop, especially when they drop a lot. If nothing else, clients get nervous. They start reaching out more, more conversations to revisit the plan or, tell people to keep on keeping on or talk them off the ledge, whatever it may be, or even opportunities for like Roth conversion. If there's a big drop in the market, that can start to open a door for tax loss harvesting or Roth conversion. So point is, market goes down, advisors necessarily get paid less under percent of asset fee, yet could very likely be doing more work, providing more value, doing more things. So tell me how that's fair or logical. Percent of assets could disincentivize distributions in retirement. Follow me here. Taking money out of investable accounts to pay down the mortgage on a house means less assets under management, less revenue for the advisor. Taking money out to buy an annuity, for example, could mean less assets under management, less for the advisor. Now, the vast majority of advisors, they are good people. They do genuinely do right, do best, have clients' best interests in mind, and act accordingly. I'm not saying this to make it sound like everyone who does percent of assets is an underhanded, nefarious advisor. Far from it. I'm just saying the underlying conflict and an inherent sort of butting of heads here is that the less assets under management, the less the advisor gets paid, and vice versa, right? So if you think about it that way, there could be some scenarios where advisors are incentivized to be like, no, don't buy that annuity. Keep your money invested. You'll do better, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, also the advisor's getting paid more from that. It could also overly incentivize doing rollovers out of employer accounts. So percent of assets generally only charges on assets directly under advisor management. It does not charge on assets held away, like if a client has assets in a 401k. Now, there are some services that can allow advisors to trade in 401ks and charge a fee on, not take the fee out of the 401k, but charge a fee on 401k balance. I'm not a fan of that arrangement or the way it's currently structured, this particular product I'm thinking of, but it is out there and it is growing in usage by some advisors. But anyway, so when you get paid, when your fee is directly, the dollar amount of fee is directly tied to asset size, and anything to make assets go up means fee goes up. So that could lead to recommending clients roll money out of employer plans into advisor management, such as in an IRA, even if it's not ultimately the best thing for the client. Now, again, I'm not saying this to make advisors sound bad. I know from what I've seen, vast majority of advisors do right by their clients, and they don't let these conflicts make glaring indiscretions in their advice. The conflict's there, but I think vast majority of advisors deal well with it. But nonetheless, there is this incentive where, and the industry has gotten a bad rap for this, where it's like, yeah, rollover, 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 rollover. Well, what if rollover is not the best option? Like, yes, the rollover means you get another 1% of those assets. So rolling over $1 million 401k can mean, $10,000 of additional revenue per year. But what if it makes more sense for the client to leave money behind, such as if, they can benefit from the rule of 55 if they're retiring earlier, or if there's lower costs in the 401k investments, or even the administrative fee is lower cost than what the advisor is going to be using, or if the 401k has access to a stable value fund that the advisor doesn't, or if the 401k has access to good annuities within the plan that the client could annuitize some or all their money within the 401k, and that would better benefit them than rolling it out to an advisor to have it managed. There's also better general creditor protection in some states by leaving money in a 401k, for example, as opposed to rolling it to an IRA. Now, that, in my opinion, isn't a driving factor for the vast majority of clients. In many states, it's not a deciding factor at all. Some states it can matter, especially for clients that are much higher litigation risk than others. So I'm not saying that to scare people or say, don't do rollovers. I'm just saying it's another potential consideration where it's in the client's better interest to not roll money over yet. Percent of assets would directly financially have incentive for the advisor to say, do the rollover. I have some sort of like scattered thoughts and questions and points. I'm just kind of blocking them together here. But next one, common question I see is 1% of assets too much? My answer is it depends. I think I said this before, but don't pay attention to the percentage you're paying. Pay attention to the dollars you're paying. That's what matters. What else in life do you measure what you pay in percentage? No, like everything gets equated back to dollars because dollars are what actually leaves your wallet every day, right? So again, the example I gave before is 1% of assets too much. Well, for client A, who had that $2 million IRA, who's super simple, yeah, 1% is too much in my opinion. They're paying 20 grand a year. For client B, that has the $1 million, has much more going on. They're paying 10 grand a year. That's probably not enough. So is 1% too much? Depends. In one case, yes. The other case, probably not, in my opinion. In some extremes, it's dirt cheap. If client has $100,000 of assets under management, advisor's charging 1%, client's paying $1,000 a year. Unless the advisor's offering a super, super, super stripped down service where you can't even call or email the advisor, they're really nothing more than like just some sort of robo type platform. $1,000 probably isn't enough, you know, regardless of asset size. Like that's almost certainly not enough. So in that case, 1% is dirt cheap. In other cases, it's way too much, in my opinion. Now, some clients charge more or less than 1%. I already sort of touched on this. Oftentimes, probably most times, if not all times, advisors have tiers or breakpoints where the first million, you know, first 500,000, your fee is whatever, 1.5, 2%. From $500,000 to $1 million, it's 1%. From $1 million to $1.5 million, it's whatever, you know, 0.9. And then it keeps stepping down. There are some advisors who charge high percentages on high amounts. Like I mentioned, there's some, you know, 1.5, even 2% on up to a few million dollars I've seen. And they'll say that that's a premium level fee because they offer premium service. Again, don't view stuff in percentage, view it in dollars. 1.5% on $5,000, I'm sorry, on $500,000 portfolio probably isn't too much. That's $7,500 a year in fee. That's probably pretty fair, give or take, on that level of assets. But 1.5% on $2 million, especially for a client that's not exceptionally complex in their financial life, that's a very different story. I have trouble justifying that. But let it be known that this, for better or worse, advisory services it's capitalism. It's a model where advisors are willing to charge or are able to charge what they want to charge. Clients are able to pay whatever they're willing to pay. There are some restrictions. For example, those that manage investments, the regulators typically won't allow charging more than 3% of assets. So that is sort of a hard limit in that sense. But otherwise, so long as the fee is below that, like, it's fair game. Advisors can charge what they want to charge. If they can find enough clients who are okay paying that, then good for them, right? They just want a capitalism. They can charge that fee because they'll have enough business from it. So the fee is a fee as long as both parties are okay with it. We live in a capitalist society and it is what it is and it's fine. So in that sense, it's like, I should probably stop yapping about this. And I know a lot of people feel that way, but I still struggle to not be like, oh man, we can do better collectively. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a bit. All right, moving on. I'm trying to not take up too much of your time here, but I'm on a roll. I still got some notes left. I had a question sent to me in email, and I touched on this in last week's Q&A episode. I'll just sort of recap it now in case people didn't hear it. The question was, is 1.25% of assets under management good if the advisor can consistently produce portfolio returns that are better than 1.25%? Again, coming back to the cost versus value, if I can consistently get, let's just say, 2% of gain, 2% of outperformance every year by the advisor, then yeah, of course I'm happy to pay 1.25% because I'm still better by 0.75%. To which I said, yes, if that's the case, sure. If you're always consistently getting more than what you're paying, 100%, it's hard to argue against the logic of saying, yes, that fee is good, that fee is fair. But my response last week, and I'll recap again, is from an investment management perspective, no one's going to consistently outperform every year. If they are, they're, you know, it's just not possible. They're doing something they shouldn't be doing, honestly. Most likely, you know, if it's too good to be true, it is. So, and also the other issue is, like I touched on before, the vast majority of advisors don't actually define and measure what outperformance is. If they did, I'd be okay with charging on a percent of the gain. For example, say, and this is just making this up, but an advisor says, our objective is we will outperform the S&P 500 by at least 2 percentage points every year. And they then set a fee and say, we will charge you, let's just say, half of that measure of outperformance. So if the S&P goes up 10% and our portfolio goes up 15%, we made you an extra 5%. We're going to take half of that. Everybody wins, right? Client, you still get money. The advisor gets money. Everyone wins. Well, great. Sounds good in theory, but there will inevitably be many times, years where the advisor's portfolio underperforms relative to the S&P or loses more relative to the S&P. Then what are you going to do, right? What do you charge on then? Is the advisor going to take zero fee? Maybe, not common, but maybe. Or realistically, you want to be more fair about it. When the advisor loses money relative to the benchmark, they should give you money back. They should rebate some of the fee they took from you in prior years, right? So that's why most advisors don't do that. And it does have really perverse incentives. It can lead to advisors taking more risk than they should to try to juice up returns and get themselves some fee. So in theory, yes, this can work if they're constantly earning you more than what they're charging you, or, you know, earning you more than what you can do on your own through some benchmark, then sure, go ahead and pay. It could be fair, but I don't think that's a great way to view it because it's not realistic. Another question, sort of related question from another listener, what if you view the percent of asset fee relative to total gain? The example was something like this. You have a $100,000 account paying a 1% fee. Let's say the account goes up 5% for the year, or you made $5,000 in total gains on your $100,000 account. Strip out your 1% fee, that's $1,000 in fees. Your $1,000 in fees was 20% of your $5,000 in gains. And the question was, isn't that excessive? I'm like, well, it depends. Maybe not. What if the gain was 20% as opposed to 5%? Then you got $20,000 in gain. You're only paying whatever, $1,200 in fee. That's like 6%, give or take. You know, the total fee is 6% of the gain. That's much more reasonable. But then the flip side, what happens when there's years where you lose? You know, like you lose 10% and you're paying a 1% fee. Well, you can't use this logic in that case because it completely falls apart. Now, I'm not saying advisors shouldn't be paid. This isn't a not-for-profit service, nor should it be. Advisors should get paid. So what I'm saying is like try to break away from having to view the fee as some percent of assets or percent of gain. Advisors don't have magic. They can't consistently outperform. We have to stop pretending like that's a reasonable way to view it. They provide a professional service. All professional service should cost something. Again, it's time, knowledge, expertise, resources you're paying for. Whether your accounts go up or go down, or you know, advice ends up being good, better, and different compared to the alternative, a professional service was still provided and should be paid accordingly. So no, to answer the listener's question, I don't think it's a fair, logical way to view any advisory fee, even percent of asset fee, as a like proportion of total gain. It doesn't really stand up or make a lot of sense in my mind. What other professional service providers charge on size or outcome or et cetera? Now, some lawyers do, like specifically those that represent you to seek monetary damages, they'll often take like 30% of the total winnings. Now that's pure alpha. And alpha in investment terms means outperformance relative to some, you know, base case. The base case in this example, you go for a lawsuit, is that if you don't go for the lawsuit, you get nothing. You know, you win zero out of it. Now maybe you can self-defend or whatever, but chances are it's not going to work. So the assumption is if you don't sue for damages and don't have a lawyer represent you, you get nothing. So by having a lawyer represent you, if you do get anything, $100,000, $1 million, whatever, it's that much more than you would have got. So that's pure gain in that sense. So sure, the lawyer takes a third of it, whatever the fee is. That makes some sense to me. Charging on total asset size does not, because you know your account value is going up. Oftentimes, isn't the advisor doing? The markets go up more times than not. It's that simple, right? So there's no advisor magic in that happening. Again, unless the advisor is defining and measuring outperformance or whatever. Generally speaking, just accounts go up more times than not anyway, because that's what the markets do. So you know, it's not fair just to charge on the going upness of it. It's not alpha in that sense. Realtors charge on asset size. Now, hot topic, I know, especially with the National Association of Realtors news recently about challenging the whatever typical 5-6% fee. I have my own thoughts about that, but you know, that's another example. I'm not saying it's the best example, but it's another example of where someone does charge on size. Otherwise, but like doctors don't, accountants don't, you're flat out not allowed to charge on like refund size when you use someone's tax return, for example. And doctors don't charge on outcomes or healthy outcomes or value provided. You know, here's an example. It's kind of cheesy, but think about this. Two people have a tumor somewhere in their body, let's say their shoulder. I don't know. It doesn't matter. So two people have a tumor on their shoulder. They both go to doctors. They both get it surgically removed. It's the exact same spot, exact same procedure. You know, both doctors need the same tools, the same anesthesiologist, the same training they have to rely on. You know, it's in the exact same spot on the shoulder. Let's assume the tumor is the exact same size, requires the same amount of work to get it off. So the doctors are going to charge the same. Again, stripping out clients could have different insurance because that completely muddies and taints the pricing of doctor services. But let's assume, take insurance out of it, doctors are going to set a fee based on whatever, let's say $30,000, I don't know. The fee they set is going to be based on, again, services provided, you know, the time it takes in the ER and what they need to pay the anesthesiologist and whatever it may be, there's going to be a fee for it. Let's say both those tumors come out, they get autopsies. In one case, the tumor is completely benign, could have stayed in the person the rest of their lives, everything would have been fine. The other person, the other patient, the tumor ends up, it was cancerous. Had it not been removed, the person would have been dead in, let's say, 3 months, 6 months, whatever, doesn't matter. Person would have died if it wasn't removed. The outcome, the value, substantially greater in that latter case where the tumor removal resulted in the person living when they otherwise would have died within a few months. In the first case, it didn't matter. Tumor could have stayed, all would have been good. Doctors don't charge on the outcome, right? So you know, why do advisors pretend to charge on value or outcome? We should provide on what goes into the service provided, is my view, a la similar to doctors. What else? Another sort of random musing. I saw a question posted on LinkedIn from a well-known person within the advisor community who's a staunch advocate of percent of assets and charging. Keep charging more, charge what you're worth, high value, high fee, premium, et cetera, et cetera. Had a question about raising fees over time. And it's like, if you don't raise your fees over time, that means one of two things. Because you get better, you get more experience, you in theory offer and provide more value over time, which I agree with those things on the surface. So the comment was, well, if you don't raise your fees over time, that means either you were overcharging to start or you're now undercharging as time goes on. And he didn't say it explicitly, but I think I know where he's going. He's referring to increasing the percentage fee charge because that's his model. He's a very, very firm advocate of it. Increasing the percentage fee from whatever 1 to 1.25 or 1.5% over time. He said, if you're not doing that, that means you were either overcharging originally or you're not, you know, you're undercharging now. My response is, well, percent of assets already has, more times than not, a built-in fee raiser. Again, don't pay attention to the percentage, pay attention to the dollars. That's what matters. Generally speaking, assets go up more than they go down, even when someone's in retirement. Many times, clients' nest eggs go up over time, over the long run. As some clients, you know, many clients do spend down and whatever, but many clients in retirement, assets actually do go up, believe it or not. So even if your percentage that you charge is fixed, the dollar amount on which you charge it often goes up. So there is already a fee raise built in more times than not with a percent of asset model. So that sort of strips out the defense of saying, well, you should increase your percentage fee over time. It's like, no, because probably you're already getting a fee increase from asset size going up. And I'll also say, you know, to that comment that, well, maybe you were overcharging initially. If you don't raise your fees, I'm going to say, well, that could very well be the case. I'll be honest, a spoiler alert, there is no right level of fee. It is hard to know what the right fee is. There's lots of ways to try to approach fees and set a fee and come up with a fee. So it is quite possible that someone is overcharging initially. Like, we don't really know. Again, with the idea of value being so impossible to fully define and so nebulous and opaque, what is the right amount of fee? Like, we don't know. So I think instead of trying to charge on that, you try to bring it back to charging on something you can sort of touch and feel, which is the what's provided. Again, the resources, the hours, the knowledge, expertise, et cetera, tie the fee to that as opposed to trying to tie the fee to something which is a sort of pie in the sky. You can't quite put your finger on it, at least not if you're being intellectually honest about it. You know, that is value and whatever. Don't pretend like you can set a fee based on that. All right, getting to the end here. So what's a better fee structure for ongoing management, investment management, and planning? Percent of assets, from client's perspective, is great for small accounts because it means, you know, they can pay whatever, a few thousand bucks a year, whatever. Not so much for clients for larger accounts. You got $2, $3, $4, $5 million. You're paying tens of thousands of dollars a year, unless you're really complex and have a lot of planning needs going on. It's just, you know, I'm going to venture to say you're most likely paying more than you need to. Complexity based makes a lot of sense again. I like that in principle. Again, it could be hard to properly implement and tweak and calibrate and stuff, but in theory, makes a lot of sense if done right. Flat fee could make a lot of sense, again, especially for cases where the advisor works with like a tightly defined scope of clients and are doing and focusing on and using the same specialization and repeatedly doing the same sort of processes and thinking about the same things over time. They can be really focused and efficient in what they do, like focusing on just distribution and retirement planning and tax planning around that. Flat fee can make a lot of sense there. Works well for many asset sizes. At the extremes, it doesn't. You know, if someone's got $200,000, a flat fee of 10 grand a year is going to be way too expensive for them. And they should probably go with a percent of assets advisor who's willing to take them on. Someone's got $50 million a year, you know, flat fee of 10,000 bucks isn't going to be enough. At some level of assets or net worth, size does matter. It's not a black and white scientific thing, but you know, $100 million is substantially more complex and more planning and more things that can royally go wrong than someone with $5 million. But someone with $5 million isn't substantially different than someone with 4 million, which isn't substantially different than someone with 3 million, with 2 million, et cetera, et cetera. So within that band of, let's just call it one-ish to five-ish million dollars, asset size frankly means next to nothing, or at least it doesn't directly translate to complexity or value to be provided or what have you, or, you know, resources or hours required. Some common support, you know, common defense of AUM is, I sort of debunk this, but folks will say more assets mean more value to be added, more complexity, et cetera, as I've already talked about. No, not the case. Coincidentally, maybe it is, but then it's just, what's the word? Cause, not effect, effect, not, whatever. It's coincidence. It's, you know, it's not one causes the other. Another one is, we're on the same side, you know, advisors are on the same side of the table as the client. We do better and you do better is the line. Well, that's just not true. The example I gave where paying down a mortgage, you know, taking money out of the investable accounts to pay down a mortgage or buy an annuity means the advisor does worse. So that should really be rephrased that we do better when you put and keep more of your money with us. It's not we do better and you do better. Again, markets go up more times than not. So accounts go up more times than not, all is equal. That means, at, you know, the fee goes up more times than not in dollars, not percentages, but in dollars. Dollars are what matters. It's simple. Percent of AUM is simple. Fully agree with that. It is. Simple to understand, simple to implement. The industry's built around it. All sorts of service providers and software providers for advisors easily incorporate percent of assets. So 100%, it is simple. I cannot dispute that in any way. It can lead advisors to work, or it can allow advisors to work with a wider range of clients. True. Like I said, especially if you don't have any asset minimums or maximums, you can work with anyone. But that means at the extremes, you are, as an advisor, you're almost certainly getting underpaid for what you do when you work with really small clients. And you are almost certainly getting overpaid for what you do when you work with really large clients. It's a means testing subsidy model in that perspective, which means you can be all things to all people and they blend out. But is that really fair? You know, is that what we want to aspire to as an industry? Another common support point of AUM is that larger assets means more potential liability for advisors. This one's sort of true. And here's what I mean by sort of. All else equal, yes. If you make, you know, you do a trade in a small account, you do the exact same trade in a large account, simply larger dollar amount means if you do make a mistake, the dollar amount of that mistake will be larger in the larger account. True. But my sort of counter to that is I genuinely feel that it's not simply asset size that leads to increase or more liability. It's activity. The higher the activity in the accounts, the more likely you are to have an error in the first place, especially account types like trading in a regular brokerage account where there's tax implications to messing something up is, in my view, more risk than trading in an IRA where there is no tax implication to buying and selling stuff within the account. You know, you're only taxed when you take money out. So I would argue that the more types of accounts a client has and the more active, you know, if you're in clients' accounts trading once a week for one client and you're trading once a quarter for another client, I would argue the one you're trading more in actually has more liability. So from that perspective, there should be a higher fee for the clients with more accounts and more activity, which comes back to this complexity concept. And you're spending more time, more resources, et cetera, right? It's not assets that determines that. It's stuff like different account types, more trading activity, whatever. So yes, there is potentially larger liability with making trade errors in larger accounts, but the possibility, the potential of an error happening in the first place is much higher when you have more account types and or more active trading. So which one's more? I don't know, but account size itself isn't the end all be all of potential liability. Wrapping up, I swear, I think, oh man, how long has this been running? This has been going a while. Is percent of AUM bad? No, it's not. It's very simple to understand and implement, but it is illogical. It is random. It is arbitrary. It is not mutually fair. Like I said before, low asset sizes, not fair to the advisor because they're getting underpaid. High asset sizes, often not fair to the client because many times they're probably overpaying. Maybe the dollar amount of fee under percent of AUM coincidentally jives and is commensurate with the type and amount of services, time, resources, et cetera, provided. Value can't be measured like some pretend it can be. It definitely isn't directly related to asset size. So let's get away from thinking that's the case. Pay attention to the dollars you're paying, not the percentage. I don't know how many times I said that, and I'll say it again. That's the most important thing here. The dollars are what you pay, not the percentage. Pay attention to that. Some advisors are overworking and undercharging themselves using percent of AUM. Others are definitely winning at capitalism, I'll call it, because of percent of AUM and working mainly or solely with really high asset clients, especially those that they don't have really high complexity to come along with it. they're likely paying more than they need to under a percent of assets because they have large asset size. Side note, I have a good family friend who worked in the investment management industry, not an advisor in that sense, just a traditional portfolio manager, stock picker for really high net worth clients, made a lot of money, retired early. He said, and I quote, I don't remember that, but I'm paraphrasing. He said one time that other than professional athletes and professional entertainers, there's no other industry that overpays people relative to what they do and the value they actually provide than investment management. And he saw that firsthand from what he did and how much was made from the services provided. So that really sat with me. You know, he said that 15 years ago, probably. And that was one of the points that really sort of drove me in my views towards all this, which I'll sort of recap at the end. And I swear we're getting to the end here somewhere. AUM advisors are not inherently bad. I said this before, I'll say it again. I'm not bagging on percent of AUM to say that people who use it are bad. Far from it. Vast majority of advisors, really good, really competent, really honest, work in the client's best interest, advisors, planners, managers. Even if they wanted to do a different fee structure, like hourly, complexity, or flat fee, they may not be able to. They may fully agree that doing something other than percent of assets is much more logical and fair, but they could be hamstrung from doing it. Maybe they're at a larger organization that will pay no mind to the idea. Maybe they have a lot of clients, you know, legacy business under percent of assets. You can't just easily flip the switch and change clients from percent of assets to one of these alternate fee structures. I realize it's really hard to do. Maybe they're plugged into some service providers that won't accommodate it, will only allow charging percent of assets or something like that. So many advisors who do these alternate fee structures like complexity-based or flat fee will not coincidentally be newer firms. They're not necessarily newer advisors. You know, they could still be quite seasoned in the industry, but they had to split out to start their own business to do things the way they want to do and charge how they want to charge. Because again, it's much harder to change in a larger legacy operation. I have this in bold. So if you're fully aware of the dollars you're paying and not percentage, but the dollars you're paying and you're comfortable with it as you feel it's worth it for what you're getting, by all means, stick with it. That applies to all fee models. Doesn't matter if it's percent of assets, flat fee, hourly complexity, et cetera, et cetera. If you feel the dollars you're paying are worth it for what you're getting, then tune me out. You know, tell me to shut up. I'm sure lots of you already are and probably already tuned out. But again, it comes down to dollars you're paying versus what you're getting. The fee model that gets there doesn't mean as much as are you comfortable with what you're paying versus what you're getting? Does it make sense for you? Yes, cool, then done. That's all that ultimately matters. There could be more logical and mutually fair ways to derive the dollar amount of fee. And that's my whole point. Shouldn't we strive to be more logical and fair? But if it works for you, works for the advisor, and you're paying under whatever fee structure, then fine, right? That's the most important thing. So why am I so vocal about fees? Well, it's from my observations as a consumer prior to being an advisor and from my time working in the institutional side of the investment management business. You know, things like that comment from that family friend really, really sat with me from 15 years ago or whatever. I realized as a consumer, when advisors would come calling, you know, I made pretty good income working in corporate finance and investments. Lots of advisors would come reaching out and, you know, often they either selling insurance or they were a percent of asset fee manager. I was like, this just doesn't make sense. You know, it seems so arbitrary the amount you're charging me based on what I actually need and services I'll get, et cetera, et cetera. It seemed illogical. And I couldn't understand why fees weren't set more like other professional services. Like I said, like lawyers, accountants, consultants, doctors, again, though doctors are a bad example because insurance really, really distorts how doctors charge for things. And I saw a lot of my prior life prior to being an advisor was I did due diligence and risk management for the large banks and brokerages that would do business with hedge funds and private equity funds. So I would be the ones who would like assess and go out and meet those funds and talk with their managers and learn their businesses and stuff like that. So I saw firsthand how much money could be made in private equity and hedge funds from their fee structures where they take a percent of assets and a percent of the gains of the fund. You know, billionaire, a lot of people, not all of them, but a lot of them multi-billionaires, a lot of them hundreds of millionaires from this. And what were they doing? You know, the service they were providing was investment management. Oftentimes the returns they produced weren't as good or were worse than what someone could freely and not freely, but could very easily and cheaply get on their own doing something else. So was it ultimately worth it? I don't know. I mean, all these places can drum up enough business that they give it a go and make a lot make a really good living doing it. And so anyway, that sort of sat with me, like, man, there's just a lot of wealth floating around in investment management, namely hedge funds, private equity funds. So that also sort of sat with me. And I realized from having studied and met with and diligence so many of these businesses, like, the work they do and what they provide isn't directly related to asset size, yet that's how the industry charges, right? So that kind of sat with me. And the more I started to really focus on and learn about retail financial advisory services and saw how they were becoming increasingly more planning focused and not just investment management, that even less supported the sensibility of charging on something as arbitrary as asset size, when the real value, again, is in the planning and all those other things, those examples of things I mentioned. So when I left the corporate world, I set out to start an advisory firm from scratch. Clean slate. I had no legacy baggage. I had no existing clients or service providers or any sort of preconceived notion that fees had to be done a certain way. So I had the benefit of starting completely from scratch, whatever fee structure I wanted. Like I said before, it's much harder for those in existing businesses to try to transition. And I completely realize and respect that. So I had the benefit of being able to do what I wanted to do, and it made it much easier than if I were to try to transition to firm. I feel I want to move the industry forward, and it sounds cheesy to say it, but I really do. Percent of AUM has been the norm, still is the norm, will be the norm for a while, but I'm convinced that's not the future. It'll still be around. It's not going away in my lifetime, definitely. And I'm challenging advisors and consumers and service providers to rethink things. Just because it's always been done doesn't mean it's the way to do it. Now, it could be very profitable. So I get why the industry is inclined to stick with it. But I feel like we owe it to everyone to be more logical, more pragmatic, more mutually fair, et cetera. Some would say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, I would say it is broke. You know, not completely busted, but it's far from optimally functioning. You know, it's far from unbroke, in my opinion. So yeah, so we should try to fix it. Now, it sounds self-serving, because my firm is flat fee, and I agree, it is in that sense. I can't argue that. I can't say it's not. I don't benefit from people becoming aware of flat fees, but you know, I'm personally not taking clients anymore. We as a firm, as one other advisor, limited like 10 more clients and that's it. And we're done taking clients and we're stopping. So I'm not doing this and saying this to try to just promote flat fee for the sake of trying to get more business. Like, sounds weird to say, but like I'm not doing this to try to get more business. We'll get business. I'm convinced we will. So I'm not doing it to try to do that. But you know, I'm still lobbying for the flat fee thing, or not just flat fee, but alternate fee structures, complexity based, hourly based, because I truly feel that's the future of the industry. So again, it sounds self-serving. It sort of is. I have to admit that, but I'm not doing this just for sake of getting business. Yes, my business is for profit and I get paid well. But I know I'm also leaving a lot of money on the table by not charging percent of assets. If I were to tell you what my revenue is relative to assets I manage, it's a joke compared to typical 1% of assets. So, you know, I know my business income and personal income could be substantially higher if I were to charge more, which I know I could, but not doing. Anyway, I'm not advocating flat fees to try to make it a race to the bottom. Contrary to what some will say, especially those that charge a lot, will say I'm a discount advisor, or those who charge flat fees are discount advisors or are cheap advisors. Quite the opposite. I mean, charging $10,000 a year or so, which is often what a flat fee is for retirement focused advisors, you know, good retirement focused advisors, that's not cheap. In what world is $10,000 a year for something cheap or discount? You know, it's not. You can flip the script and put it the other way. It's all relative to what your perspective is. Someone charging 30 grand a year may say 10 grand a year is cheap. You can flip it around and be like, no, 10 grand a year is much more closer to fair. 30 grand is overpriced, right? So it's all in the eye of the beholder. And even think about hours. Now, this varies a lot. But let's just assume average hours per year spent on a client, not directly talking to a client, but like doing work relating to a client and everything, 20-ish hours a year, give or take. $10,000 a year fee equates to about $500 an hour. Like that's good. That's a good living. That's not cheap by any definition. Advisors charging 30 grand a year, spending about 20 hours a year or so on a client. And do the math. What's the fee on that? I can't even do it that quick in my head, but I got a calculator. 30,000 divided by 20. It's like $1,500 an hour. That's a lot, right? Whatever. I guess a lot is all in the eye of the beholder. So I'm really just challenging everyone, consumers, advisors, the industry service providers, to be intellectually honest and really think about fee structures, realizing nothing is perfect, Agreed. But can't it be better? And shouldn't we strive for better? So long as it's feasible to actually make changes that result in things that are more logical, or shall I say less illogical, less unfair, don't we owe it to everyone to do that? Just to recap, these are the points I opened with in the beginning and I wanted to say again because I think it's important. No fee model is perfect, but some are more imperfect than others. No fee model is free from conflict, but some are more prone to conflicts than others. Virtually no advisor works for free, shy of a pro bono offering. If you think you're working for, you know, if you think you got a free advisor, you're almost certainly not. You're either paying commission on products they're selling you, or you're paying through, you know, through assets or something, you just don't know it. Pay attention to the dollars you're paying, not the percentage. Percentage don't matter. Translate that to dollars. How many dollars a year are you paying? Do you feel it's worth it for what you're getting? If the answer is yes, good. Happy for you. If the answer is no, you got to rethink things. There's no universally right, quote unquote, right amount of fee. But so long as you feel you're getting more value than what you're paying, service is good for you and can make sense. Finally, most of the value in a good advisory relationship is impossible to quantify. So be skeptical of any advisor who pretends that he or she can make any sort of formal or informal promise that they will deliver at least more value or a certain amount of value or double the value or whatever compared to their fee. Because that's, as you'll see in the article I'm linking here, that's just not the case. I don't know. I'm thinking there's a slick term to explain that. But anyway, that's it. That's my talk on fees. Hopefully you found this helpful. I'm sure I angered a lot of you, especially a lot of the advisors listening. But these are my genuine thoughts. I want to put it out there. For better or for worse, this is how I feel. And I can say firsthand, a lot of advisors have been gravitating and this message resonates with them about fees and alternate fee structures. So hopefully 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, the advisory industry and the scope of services and fee structures provided will be very different than it is today. I'd like to think I had just a little piece to do with that, but time will tell. Anyway, that's that. I'm done. I'm thirsty. I hope you enjoyed this. As always, if you do like this podcast, it would be greatly appreciated if you would leave a review in whatever podcast listening platform you use to soak up this glorious audio-ness. If you haven't already, check out the Retirement Planning Education website, where you can find links to the YouTube channel of the same name, Facebook group, which is getting a lot of spammers lately. It's kind of annoying trying to weed all them out, and the podcast and a whole bunch of free stuff, which I'm sure you'll dig. And that's it. All right. That's my chat on fees, my rant on fees, my soapbox on fees. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Thank you all for listening. I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.